Thank you. My name's Leonard, and I am an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Joseph. Thank you. I'd like to thank Joseph for inviting me to come down here to speak from L.A., and it's always a privilege to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. When I got here, people were not inviting me to come any place to speak or even participate at the end. I was not a attraction. Some days I feel like I'm still not. When I got here, I did not know I was alcoholic, but I knew I was crazy. And like a lot of us, I grew up in what seemed like a normal family. This was in Detroit, Michigan. It was a Jewish family, and my father worked 7 days a week. This was back in the 50s when I was a kid, and it seemed normal that my dad worked 7 days a week. I wore hand-me-downs as a kid. If my brother had a pair of slacks that I liked or a shirt, or my cousin had a shirt that I liked, I knew next year it would be mine. That was great. And it was a family where I had two kinds of shoes when I grew up. They were both brown. One was the scuffed up pair, and the other was the ones for dress, and they were Boy Scout shoes. And then when the other ones got destroyed, they'd matriculate up. So that's the way it was when I was growing up. Also, my father worked hard. He worked 7 days a week, long hours. He had a corner grocery store, and he wanted it quiet at the dinner table. And I had an older brother. I had two brothers, one older and younger. No sisters. And my older brother always sabotaged me. He'd stick mashed potatoes out on his tongue when nobody else was looking. And I'd start laughing, and then I'd get a beating for that. And that was my life story. My older brother could do no wrong. He was the firstborn boy on either side of the family. And when I came along as a second, my dad just, I could do no right. It wasn't I was a bad kid or did anything wrong. He just seemed to have it in for me. And when my younger brother came along, he was the baby of the family. He got away with everything. And so I just used to get hit a lot, and I just got used to that. By the time I was in high school, we had moved, and we had moved from the neighborhood when I grew up in at 13, and then we moved to this better neighborhood. My father was doing better in his store. And this new neighborhood, I did not fit in at all. I always seemed to be kind of a loner, had problem making friends. My older brother seemed to have a cadre of guys that he hung out with. But in this new neighborhood, it was more affluent. And all the kids wore slacks and white shirts to school with the red sleeveless vest. It was the 50s. American Bandstand was now on television. And I didn't fit in. I was wearing actually khakis like I have on today, only they had the 2-inch cuffs on the bottom. They sold them at Sears Roebuck with the tunnel belt loops. They come in khaki and the purple green. They still sell them at Sears. Those were my dress pants. That's what I wore for school every day. And in that new neighborhood, I didn't fit in at all. And in the new neighborhood, most of the kids came from families where their fathers wore a suit and tie to work. They were doctors, attorneys. We had a state senator living down the block about four houses. And I was ashamed of my family. I just, my father always drove a station wagon. He had a grocery store, and every morning he'd leave at 5:30, 6 o'clock to pick up produce and meats for the store. And the station wagon always smelled like rotten greens because that's what he'd put in the back. You never get them all out. And so that's when my alcoholism began, after we moved to this neighborhood. And it began before I ever picked up the first drink. It began when I tried to prove I didn't need the other kids and I was better than they were. And I did that by accelerating in school. I worked really hard. I won awards for writing, for journalism. I was editor of school paper in the yearbook. I won awards for art and stuff and wound up going to special high school in Detroit. And it was a time in America where Sputnik was in space in 58, 59. And we were behind in the sciences, so colleges came in to top schools in all the major cities to teach accelerated and advanced classes. We still have them today in magnet schools and stuff, but that's when it began. University of Michigan came into this high school I was in. It was a special school, 5,000 students. It was open to three counties, and I loved it because I didn't go to the neighborhood high school because I didn't like these kids. And at this high school, you had people, guys and girls, that were really working hard. And so we took all these classes, and some days I'd be in school from 6:30 in the morning to 8 o'clock at night taking these classes, and it was like going to junior college, and it was wonderful. And I majored in pre-med and fine art in high school, and I won a lot of awards in the summer scholarship to San Luis Obispo from Detroit, studying marine biology for 2 weeks. When it was time for me to leave the week before, I called and canceled out my trip because I had another problem back then. I was what was known as a late bloomer. At the time I was 16, and I was about 4 feet 10 and looked like a little kid, because I was, even at 16. When I graduated high school, I was 17 and was 5 feet 1 and looked about 13 years old. It was just the way it is, and so I had problems getting along. Also, I was excused from gym in junior high, high school, and college because I had flat feet really bad and my knees would buckle under me sometimes. Alcoholics Anonymous resolved that for me. Anyways, what happened is I got a scholarship out here and I came out to California to go to school, to art school out here, which later became CalArts. And up until this time, I never drank. We just had like sweet kosher wines on the Jewish holidays, and you'd have to put it to your lips for the ritual. I hated the smell of those sweet kosher wines. I hated the taste of it. And after I met you people here in AA, I discovered a lot of you drank sweet kosher wines, and you weren't even Jewish. But I came out to college. I was living down by MacArthur Park in L.A. It was a CD area. It still is now. And I went to my first school party a couple weeks in the semester. To date the period, I was living in a single apartment for $50 a month. It was in the CD area down by school. And I went to this party, and I remember about 10:30 at night stepping over a couple people passed out on the floor. And I didn't know they were drunk and passed out. I thought maybe they were tired and just fell asleep. I was very naive. We worked long hours at school and stay up all night sometimes on projects. And about 2 weeks later, the guys who lived in the building next to me were from Lubbock, Texas. They came and got me on a Sunday afternoon. And they said, "Leonard, come with us. We're going to teach you how to drink." And I went with them. We went to Save-On Drugstore. We bought a fifth of whiskey, went back to their place. And they poured me 2 water glasses of whiskey. And they told me to chug-a-lug it. I did not know what that meant. Growing up in Detroit, I never heard that colloquial expression before. But I figured it out, and I downed those 2 glasses, and it was like gasoline going down. I'm sputtering and choking and coughing. It's cauterized my throat. I can hardly breathe. And then Danny said, real quickly, said, "Here, you need to eat some Mexican food. It'll kill the taste." He had made Mexican food. He was from Lubbock, Texas. You know, Tex-Mex. I've never had Mexican food before in my life. You don't get carnitas in a kosher home. And I ate it, it kind of killed the taste. And what happened for me, after a few minutes, I could feel all that tension and pressure in my neck and shoulders start to dissipate. And I'm feeling silly and giddy. I'm laughing. And I had that stress and tension in my neck my whole life. The only way I could feel it was its absence, is it's from getting drunk. it just it melted it away. And I'm laughing, and I'm starting to rip out books out of their bookcases. I'm doing somersaults on the floor and across one of the beds. And Danny, who was about 6'1", grabbed me by the seat of my pants and the scuff of my neck, and I'm 5'1". And he hauls me out in the hall and threw me down a flight of stairs. And it was like slow motion. It was like that. And I crawled over to my building next door, and I lived on the second floor at my place, and I laid in bed that night watching the ceiling spin all night. And I thought, this is terrific. This is wonderful. I finally have grown up and become a man. I got drunk for the first time. And that's the way I drank ever since. I'd go to a school party, I'd give somebody money, and they'd buy me a pint of vodka or gin, and I'd chug-a-lug it and then eat something real quick, some chips or something, to kill the taste. It took me about 4 months to become a sophisticated drinker. And what happened is, just to back up for a second, I think a lot of us start drinking for the same experience that I had. When I got drunk at those parties, now I can talk to girls, I can dance, I could make a total fool out of myself without being the least bit self-conscious. And I think a lot of us in our late teens and 20s, where today it's our late adolescence, start drinking for the very same reason. And when I got here, people used to say, Leonard, if you need a drink to be social, you are not a social drinker. I don't hear that these days, but that's what I could relate to when I was new. And so about 4 months of drinking, I discovered I could mix the vodka with orange juice, and now I can sip it. Now I'm sophisticated. And the first year of college, I discovered that I like dried white wines. That's my drink of choice. I like those tart tastes. Even today, I can just have a salad and put vinegar on it. I like tart tastes. I'm not big on sweets and desserts and candies. And we all have our preferences about what we drink, what foods we like, and that's something I discovered about myself back then. And that beer was good on Wednesdays when you go wash your clothes with the other guys at the laundromat. Over the next several years of college, I dropped out a couple times to work full-time because tuition was on scholarship, but I had my living expenses and art supplies and stuff. And I got into the wonderful world of motorcycles, too. I'd gone back to Detroit after my first year. My buddy had a bike, and I decided I need to have one, too. I remember going back, and it was over my friend Joel's house, and his mother said, isn't that terrible? Joel is riding a motorcycle now, and he has motorcycle boots, and you wouldn't do that, would you, Leonard? I said, no, I wouldn't. 2 weeks later, I had my first motorcycle. I bought a $175 motorcycle, used, and I didn't even know how to ride a bike, but I learned. My buddy had to ride it home. We bought it used in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Over the next several years, I had 5 bikes. I graduated to larger bikes, a 250 Yamaha, 500 Triumph, a 750 Norton Atlas, 750 Moto Guzzi. I've ridden to about 30 states on motorcycles, a couple times cross-country with a girlfriend at the back, on the back. And I used to drink in Santa Monica at a bar called the Oar House. O-A-R, like the oar of a boat. And I used to drink for basically for free at that place. I don't know how alcoholics think that we have these epiphanies, but I discovered that when I wrote, if I wore an Arab burnoose to this bar, it was a college bar with 14-foot ceilings, everything hanging off the walls and ceiling and sawdust on the floor, anything other than a California beach accent, they would think I was a foreign exchange student. So all I had to do was buy my first beer and afterwards just hold it out and people would fill it for me. And I'd get totally wasted, and by the time it came to riding home at 1 or 2 in the morning, I'd have to close one eye and use all 3 lanes of the freeway like this. It's amazing I didn't kill anybody or myself or get a ticket. But that's what I used to do. And I also used to hang out at bars on the Sunset Strip. And the police would hassle me sometimes. Over the years that I was drinking, I got arrested probably about 8 or 10 times for disturbing the peace, where they just, you know, pull you in and then let you go. They don't even book you. That's when it's scary, when you're not booked, but they take you and lock you up, especially in small towns in the Midwest. And one time this guy grabbed me, this sheriff or something, and I'm, you know, I weighed a whole 119 pounds. And he lifted me up like this, and I said, "You can't arrest me. It's illegal and stuff. I want to talk to the chief of police and file a complaint." And he's holding me in the air, actually with one arm, and he's telling me I am the chief of police. He threw me in a cinder block cell, and I was terrified because nobody knew where I was, and there's no booking, there's no records. He came and got me about 6 hours later and let me free, but those were scary things for me. I even got arrested here in L.A., for a felony drug charge one time for one joint of marijuana in 1969. Back then, it was very illegal, and it was an illegal search and seizure. So I'm an intellectual, like all us alcoholics. I called the ACLU. They recommended an attorney, and I hired him. He had never done a criminal case before in his life. He was a civil rights guy, and I wound up being convicted. The sentence was 2 years in prison, and the judge busted it down. They took it from a felony to misdemeanor. The misdemeanor was 2 years in prison, but he gave me credit for the couple days I spent in the felony holding tank, which scared the crap out of me. I was like 25 years old, and I'm in a felony tank with guys in there for murder and rape and, you know, really major crime, stabbings, and I'm a nice little Jewish boy. What's going to happen to me? I had hair down to my shoulders. I'm wearing a tank top, cut-off jeans, and tennis shoes with no socks. I didn't go to sleep for 2 days. We refer to that in AA as a rude awakening. I had to have friends contact my parents back in Michigan to raise bail money for me. And I wound up, like I said, I was convicted, but the judge gave me credit for time served, and I was on probation for 2 years. And a fine, I think, was $2,000 or $5,000. I'm not sure what it was. But I realize normal people don't have those kind of problems. Anyways, I'm graduated college. I moved into a 2,000-square-foot studio with 10-foot ceilings doing my artwork. I was floundering like a fish out of water. I was working nights for a printing company. I'd worked in art studios, but I got tired of starving. And my friends that I, from school and stuff, people didn't want to have anything to do with Leonard anymore because I was kind of crazy. It's just the way it was. And I took another geographic. And does everybody know what a geographic is? If you do, raise your hand. Okay. There's a few that didn't raise your hand. It's a lateral move. My problem is my drinking and drugs staring straight in front of me, and I'm thinking if I get a new job or a new girlfriend or a new motorcycle or a car or a new place to live, it's going to fix everything. And I decided in my infinite alcoholism wisdom that if I went back to college and learned Spanish, everything would be okay. And that's what I did. I went to L.A. City College. I'd already graduated a few years before from CalArts, but it didn't cost anything there. And I met a guy in my class. We talked about all the drinking and partying we did and how cool we were. And then he told me he was a member of a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous, and he hadn't had a drink or a drug in over a year. And I looked, and he wanted me to go to a meeting with him. And I looked David right in the eye and called him a liar. I told him he was too together to have any problems. And I refused to go to the meeting, and he gave me a copy of our big book to take home and read. I took it home and did not read it. But I returned it 2 weeks later, and I lied to him. I told him I did. And we all know why I did that. Alcoholics are all intellectuals, and God forbid somebody should think I didn't read a book. So I returned it, told him I read it when I didn't. And a few weeks later, I went to my first AA meeting. It took me a few months to figure out what happened. I didn't remember clearly that night what had transpired, but I knew David didn't have a car, and I had no idea where a meeting was. So I had picked up David, and we went together to a meeting. And it was the largest meeting of AA at the time in Los Angeles. It was the Sunday night Wilshire Fellowship. It was in the basement of a church, and there were about 300 people there. And they sat me down early, an hour before the meeting started, introduced me to young people, new people that were younger people in AA, people, young people, the designation is people under 40. Because the average age in AA, people came in their early 40s back then. And they sat around me, and that night I heard a speaker tell my life story. I had never heard anybody tell my life story before, and I had been in therapy for the previous 3 years. Till that time, I was in primal therapy. I had heard a guy on the radio about 3 years earlier, knew I had a lot of problems, and I called the radio station, as before talk radio, and he said he was the guy for me, and he was doing a workshop that weekend in Woodland Hills, California. And I should come to and attend that workshop. And I went out in Woodland Hills in somebody's backyard. They had a swimming pool. We all stripped down in the nude for 48 hours in a swimming pool. And I knew that was going to fix it for me. And I continue in that therapy. It was called primal therapy for the next 3 years. Every morning on Saturday, I'd go to his office. They'd give me a tab of acid. A few hours later, they put me in a dark, soundproof cubbyhole room, and I'd regress for 3 hours, crying on the floor, and it was to relive all those memories of childbirth and whatever else. The bottom line is, over the next 3 years with therapy with this guy, I got totally crazy. And the last year, I could not ride on an elevator or an escalator and could not go into a restaurant. Literally, just standing in front of a restaurant was like standing in front of a 30-foot tidal wave. It frightened me to death. So here I am now at my first AA meeting, and I heard a speaker that night tell my life story, and the speaker talked about not knowing how to grow up, not knowing how to be an adult, and not knowing how an adult acted and felt inside. I'm 28 years old. All my friends friends left from high school and stuff, they have their careers, they're getting married now, they're doing all those things in life, and I don't know how to run around. I don't know how to grow up. I'm running around with hair down to my shoulders and hippie beads and trying to keep it cool, and I have no friends left, and I'm paranoid, and at night I have to leave the TV and the radio on all the time and check the doors and windows to make sure nobody's going to break in. I'm in bad shape. And that night at the meeting, I heard the voice in my head speak to me. I had never heard the voice in my head speak to me before. Even with all the acid I took and stuff, I never heard the voice in my head. And it said to me, "Leonard, you're home. These people understand you." And they were thanking the speaker after the meeting, and I went through this line, and I told the speaker, "I don't have a problem with alcohol and drugs, but I know I'm crazy." And she gave me the absolute best advice I've heard in my 44 years of sobriety. Without hesitating a millisecond, she said to me, "Leonard, when the beginning of the meeting, they asked for people to raise their hand for being an alcoholic, raise your hand and pretend they say the word neurotic, but don't drink or don't use for 30 days. Nobody thinks that fast on their feet except an alcoholic. Anyways, the bottom line is I went to my second meeting a week later. It was a Saturday meeting, and I was going to my therapy that morning, and I told the doctor I didn't take the acid, and I told him I was going to. When he came around, he had about 7 patients he saw. He spent 5 or 8 minutes with each patient going around all day long for 7 or 8 hours. I told him I was going to AA, and he told me I just needed about 3 more years of therapy with him. That AA was just a big tit to suck on. And three more years with him would fix it. And then when he went on to the next patient, I ran out of the room and haven't been back since. And I went to my second meeting that night. It was a young people's meeting I was directed to by my friend David. He wasn't going to be there. He was out of town. And I sat in a basement of a church, about 70 people, in an aisle, middle aisle seat, about seven rows back. And a fellow by the name of Andy Cochran spoke that night. It was Capasso, this and back, a short guy pacing up and back in his talk. And I remember hearing somebody sobbing. And as I opened up my eyes, I realized it was me. I was sprawled out on the floor. I had had a grand mal seizure. Now, I didn't know I had a grand mal seizure. All I know is I heard somebody crying, sobbing. And as I pushed myself up off the floor, I crawled back to my seat. I was about 15, 20 feet from where I had been sitting. I kind of, you know, flop out. And the woman who was sitting next to me just put her arm around my shoulder, and I cried the rest of his pitch in her lap. And Eddie was a consummate speaker. He was sober about 15 years at the time. He never hesitated in his talk. He just went right on. Half the meeting was standing up looking at me. I was embarrassed to death. And then after the meeting, I was so rubbery, I could hardly stand. And you people took me out to a restaurant and sat with me for 2 or 3 hours and gave me your phone numbers on torn scraps of paper and told me to keep coming back. You told me where meetings were. And that was August 6th, 1972. And it's not me, it's the program. That was Saturday night. Sunday night, I went to the same meeting I'd gone the week before, and I talked to some of the people I met. I started going for the first year. I averaged 13 or 14 meetings a week. Monday, I went to work. At lunch break, I'm sitting in my car eating a sandwich. My lunch break is over, and I had started crying, and I couldn't stop, and I'm panicking. I'm a grown man. I should be able to stop crying. I should be able to control. I couldn't. I didn't know what to do, but I'm an intellectual. I drove home and called in sick for the second half of my shift. Went back to work Tuesday. The same thing happened again Tuesday. Now I'm frightened to death. So I called one of those phone numbers I had on those torn scraps of paper. I called the most together guy I met in AA. He was a cowboy. And we all know how to tell a real cowboy. They wear Wrangler jeans. We all know real cowboys do not wear Levi's. And they had the suede vests that were rawhide vests that were popular back in the late 60s, early 70s. So I told this guy, and he told me that some of us come in sicker than others, and maybe I needed to go on disability. There weren't the recovery programs around then that there are today. That didn't happen until 79 and 80 when the insurance industry realized they could make money off of recovery facilities. Before that, AA was the last house on the block. That's a little bit of my opinion and fact. The bottom line is I went on state disability. I don't know. To this day, I don't remember doing it. I don't know how I got it. But I worked for a printing company, and it was a union job, and I had to call my union. And they wanted me to come down and fill out a form because they'd pay me an extra $50 a week if I'm on disability. So I go down there and I filled out the form, and it asked me what's the nature of my illness and the symptoms. I couldn't put down I'm an alcoholic because I'll never get work again in the printing industry. I'll get fired from the job I have. But it asked for the symptoms. I could put down that I'm paranoid, that I'm unstable, that I cry all the time, that I wet the bed, and the last thing I think I put down was I wet the bed, and I could fill all that out, and then they gave me $50. Such a deal. And the next week I went to call in, you know, to let them know I'm still on disability. They said, no, you have to show up here. We want to make sure you're not working. And I walk in and I hear the secretaries go, isn't that sad, poor Leonard. And so I was on disability for about 3 months and went back to work. And nobody said anything at work. I just went back to work and stuff. And that first day and second day I was off, it was the first day was a Wednesday, the first day on disability. I went to one of those noon meetings, you know, the loser meetings where there's 15 people, they're newcomers and people that can't get a job or other newcomers that are going blah, 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 like that. And they went around the room. I sat down. I was there an hour before the meeting started. I didn't know what to do. And a fellow sat down next to me. I could not turn my head to see who it was because he frightened me so much. He had hair frizzed out to here. A white dude with hair frizzed out to here. And this is 1972. And they went around the room, they called on me, and all I could say is, my name's Leonard, and I'm new, and I don't know what's going on. That's all I could say and try not to cry. And he shared after me, he was Jewish and from New York. I could relate to him. And afterwards, he did something for me that I recommend everybody here. One, he invited me out to lunch with him and a friend. And they took me out to lunch. And then he gave me his phone number on a piece of torn scrap of paper. And he told me to call him the next day at 9 a.m. He did not ask me if I wanted to call him the next day at 9 a.m. He didn't ask me if I thought it was a good idea to call him the next day at 9 a.m. He just told me to do that, and I didn't know that these are suggestions. I'm new. I don't know this is a suggestion. So I called him the next morning at 9 a.m., and I went to meeting with him. I started calling him 2 and 3 times a day or night. I'm paranoid. I can't sleep. I call him 2 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning. He'd answer the phone and talk to me and I started going to meetings with him. I thought he was about 10 years older than me. It turned out he was about 6 years younger than me. I felt like such a little boy when I got here. And he was on term break. He was a student at UCLA in his early 20s. And I started going to meetings with him, and he introduced me around to a lot of people. We drove for meetings from Laguna Beach to Malibu. We went all over. And I got involved. I was going to, like I said, 13, 14 meetings a week the first year, at least 8 meetings a week for the first 3 years. And Neil took me, I asked him about 2 weeks later to be my sponsor. He took me through the steps and through the book that first year. And I know to this day that God absolutely put that man in my life because he totally changed my life. He had me do things I would never do or understand. Like, I get up every morning, I have to say my prayers and make my bed. It has to be straightened up before I leave the bedroom. I have to say prayers at night before I go to sleep. He had me be involved and do things, and it changed my life. I hung out with people on the program. I had no friends left at the time. I used to go to dinner, and he had me have commitments at every meeting I went to, not the formal ones like we have today where you sign up and you do this task or that task. It was just you show up an hour early, and you set up chairs, you wash ashtrays, you put out cups and wash cups, you mop the floors at the end of the meeting, and then what happened, we'd always meet before meetings for dinner. After meetings, we'd go to a restaurant and have dessert or sit and talk, and on weekends, we'd spend several hours at restaurants between the day meeting and the night meeting. That's the way it was, and it was great, and it changed my life, absolutely changed my life. He also did something for me. He told me I needed to join the Hollywood YMCA. Thank you. And I had, I said I didn't need to do that. I was excused from gym in junior high school and college. He didn't want to hear that. He said, you abused your body your whole life. You need to go to fitness class at least 3 days a week and work out. So I joined the Hollywood Y. It turned out it was like going to the Jewish Center. It was like all people in the entertainment industry, and I enjoyed it. And I used to be invited to go skiing every year from my buddy. We were best friends in high school, and since we're still good friends. And he'd invite me to go skiing every year. He's a doctor with him and his other doctor friends. And I'd always turn him down. And the reason was because I grew up in a poor family. We don't ski. We don't play tennis. That's out of bounds for us. And I was sharing to a friend of mine before a noon meeting one day, about a year sober, and that I was invited to go skiing, and I'm not going. He said, why aren't you? I said, well, I can't do that. My father works 7 days a week and blah, blah, blah. He said, why don't you need to bring that up at the discussion meeting today. And like a fool, I brought it up. And they got into me. They said, Leonard, can you afford to fly to Aspen, Colorado and pay the airfare? I said, yeah. They said, then you can go skiing. I said, no, you don't understand. I wore hand-me-downs as a kid. And I gave them all these. They said, well, can you afford to rent ski equipment? I said, yeah, then you can go. I said, no. You know, my father works 7 days a week and blah, blah, blah. The bottom line is the whole meeting was focused on Leonard and why I should go skiing. And I refused to give in. The next week, they didn't wait for me to bring it up. You know how alcoholics are persistent? They brought it up at this discussion meeting. And finally, by the end of the meeting, I said, okay, I give up. I'll go skiing. And they told me that I had to remember to take lessons so I wouldn't have to unlearn all the mistakes to take lessons. So I wound up going to Aspen, Colorado, and I signed up for lessons. And they set you off skiing, learning on 3-foot skis with no poles on a bunny slope. The slope's twice the length of a football field, and it has 10 feet of vertical gain. So if you want to start going downhill, you have to kind of chug like this with your body. And they teach you to fall to the side so you absorb the shock. So that was basically the whole first day. The lesson's over for the day. And then the instructor says, there's 45 minutes left before the lifts close if you want to practice some more. And, you know, I'm Jewish. I'm going to get my money's worth. I go out on the slopes. And they have 5 chairs that come to the bottom of Ajax Mountain. It's late in the day. I'm getting confused. I got on the wrong lift. It went halfway up the mountain, 200 feet above the tree line or something. I'm holding on for dear life. I said the serenity prayer between 300 and 800 times. I'm terrified. And when it's time to get off, I'm yelling at the lift operator that I can't ski, that I have to go back down. He said, nobody goes down. You have to get off the chair. And so I did, and I keep ducking because people are coming down that mountain with what seems like 20-foot skis over my head, and I have to keep ducking to keep from getting decapitated. And he told me, the lift operator, when I told him I don't know how to ski, he said, go over to the side. It's powder. You'll be okay. I go over there, and powder doesn't support somebody on 3-foot skis. I just sink up to my nose. This is not an exaggeration, folks. And I start doing the breaststroke through the snow. And at that point, the lifts are closing. There's nobody coming back down the mountain, and I can yell for help. And I realize that, you know, I'm going to be okay. It's not the end of the world. And because I know they have the skiers that come down for the patrol, that they'll find me and stuff. And I could see the bottom with the smoke coming out of the chimney about 2 miles down below. And I did the breaststroke some more. I got over to hard packed snow. And then I could ski 10 feet and fall the whole rest of the way down. I was so exhausted. I got down there about a half hour after everything was closed. My friends that were back in town, I had to take a bus in and find them. It was the worst thing that could have happened. And I survived. I took lessons for the rest of the week. That last day on a Saturday, I skied with my friends. And they were amazed that I could ski as well as them. Part of it, I was in good physical condition. I've been working at the gym for about a year and a half already. So it's just endurance and stuff. But I enjoyed skiing. Within 2 years, I discovered I really, really liked to ski. And I took lessons to race. And I started racing giant slalom on the amateur circuit for a few years. I had my racy, skin-tight racing outfit and international orange Rossignol Rock comp skis. And in AA, you can do whatever you want. I wound up doing things like skydiving, jumping out of an airplane 3 years sober. I used to say to people when I got invited, I had friends on the program that jumped. I said, I can't do that. I never told them why, because I felt like it would kill me. One morning I woke up with the realization out of a dream that you can take a 100-pound sack of potatoes, put it on a parachute, throw it out the airplane, it'll still land and you can make French fries. It's not that it's going to kill me, it feels like it's going to kill me. Big difference. And so a few weeks later, I wound up going skydiving. I was game for that. I discovered the lessons for the half a day. Then they take you up in an airplane. You step out on the wing on a little 2x4 sticking out of the fuselage, and they tap you on the leg. It's all silent commands because you can't hear over the roar of the engine. And you fall over backwards and yell, Geronimo. And then you pull your thing. Well, I yelled over backwards, and I don't remember yelling Geronimo. I think I might have blacked out. But there's a 30-foot or 50-foot cord that's static line tied to the plane, so it'll rip your shoe open whether you remember to pull it, to release or not. And then it opens up, and you're wide awake, and it was a great experience. You know, we learned to change our language in sobriety. It isn't that it scares me to death. It's thrilling. Totally different concept. But after I did that, I realized I didn't need to be thrilled again. I've had 5 sponsors over the years I've been sober. And my first sponsor fired me after 1 year. He said he only worked with new people. I've had sponsors I've moved on when I thought it was necessary for me. 3 of my sponsors have passed away. And they've allowed me to grow and change in ways that I never dreamed imaginable. From being on disability and getting $50 a week from that union, a few years sober, they invited me to be on negotiations for an area contract regarding about 2,000 employees. And they had called me into the office, and when they asked me if I'd be willing to do that, I told them that that was a lot of responsibility, and I'd have to think about it and give them my decision, that whatever I decided, I wanted to thank them for considering me, and I was deeply touched that they think of asking me. And then I talked to my sponsor about it, and he asked me if I would like to do it. I said, yeah. And he pointed out that was a very mature response that I had. If I wasn't sober, I would have told them, God damn it, you should ask me 3 years ago when we got that rotten contract. You know, it was that kind of the way that we are. But now it was a very mature and proper response. And I wound up being in those negotiations. And it took about 4 or 5 months to settle that contract. It represented several shops around City LA, about 2,000 workers. And one of the things that happened, I knew I couldn't let anybody know I'm in AA or have a problem. And we'd go out to lunch or dinner after negotiations on those days. It was with the heads of 5 major or 6 major companies, corporations. And we're at lunch one day, and something came up, and so he was talking about some problems. And I forgot to keep my mouth shut. I didn't say I was in AA, but they asked me something, and I said, yeah, I had a problem with alcohol and drugs. I just had slipped out. I'm in recovery or something. And I didn't think anything about it till I went home and I realized what I had done. And now I had to resign from the committee because I'm embarrassed to death. I can't face these men again. They were all like 15, 20 years older than me. I'm the young kid on the committee. And so I didn't know what to do, but I had a friend of mine on the program. And what we learn here, that any problem I have, there's people in AA that have experience with it and in sobriety. And I called this friend of mine on the program. He was vice president for a printing company. And I called him and told him what happened. And he said, Leonard, maybe God wanted you to share that with at that lunch that day, today, because you're going to have opportunity to help somebody. Maybe that helped one of the men there. And I'm thinking to myself, Cedric, you're full of shit. If I wanted that advice, I'd have called my sponsor and said, and that was totally different than what I expected Cedric to say. He's a real practical guy. And the next day, one of the men there called me and saying how much I helped for him to talk with me with the problem he's having with his son. And we have those experiences in sobriety where God intervenes and we know we're doing God's will. The bottom line, I've been able to grow up. Eventually, I became president of this labor union. I never expected to do that, but from working the steps, I was willing to take on responsibilities that I'd never been able to do before. I let the buck stop with me and was able to stand in those kind of positions. My time is up, so I just want to add two little things to this. One is with the story I told you about skiing. It's really how the program works for me and most of us. The big book is our directions, our tutelage, having a sponsor and stuff, following directions so we don't have to keep on doing mistakes, so we learn and grow. I've grown up on the program, whether I'm dressed in cutoffs and a tank top or I'm dressed in a suit and tie, it makes no difference anymore for me in life. I'm comfortable with who I am. And I never thought that was possible. I've gone through all the life experiences we have and other people have in life. Marriage and divorce. I got married 7 years sober and I thought it was the best thing that ever happened to me. 3 years later, I got divorced, and that was the best thing that ever happened. I've gone through the death of my parents and having them move out to L.A., and I looked after them, and it was the best thing I ever did. I speak to groups today about taking care of one's parents when they're dying, because we get to be whole and resolve all our conflicts in life by not having that being on our shoulders and the burden anymore. And it's all available for every one of us. So if you're new or whether you're old, get phone numbers, talk to people, share. I do that every day. I'm talking with people on the program. And be of service. It's really important to help you keep your sobriety. You know, people talk about relapse. Relapse is really not a part of sobriety. Sobriety is sobriety. So, you know, you get sober, you don't have to go back out again. So thank you and God bless.